Hello and welcome to the review here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, and Emma Nelson.
Ahead in the next hour, we'll be checking out what the hits are in the bookshops of Sydney, Delhi and Istanbul.
And we'll be learning quite a dose of the Finnish music scene together with Finnish DJ and musician Marcus Nordenstrang.
And we'll have a big pile of magazines to go through together with the art director and designer Michael Salu.
All right here on the review on Monocle 24. And a good afternoon from London. Hello, Emma.
Good afternoon from London and from Emma.
As well. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Very well, thank you.
Good.
Plowing through papers and
absolutely.
Magazines.
Absolutely.
The review is the correct name for this program,
it is.
Isn't it?
We've done a real trolley dash around the neighbourhood this morning. So I think we'll start with a couple of newspapers this morning. And then we've also got, as you were saying in the intro, we've got Michael Salu coming in and we're going to be doing all of the magazines, and then also we're going to be heading up to Helsinki as well. So anyway,
for some wonderful music from
absolutely.
Finland.
It's a gorgeous day out today.
It is lovely. I haven't seen much of it.
No, it's good. Perfectly in line. Plug my column, but why not? In the FT today, I was writing about how I think a lot of publishers and owners of media companies forget about how important the weather is to media consumption, and I firmly believe that when the pressure is high and the sun is out and it's sort of crisp and autumnal, it's just the type of weather that you want to cozy up with a really good book, and you want to go in and just have a great stack of magazines. And of course, listen to good radio,
and
right?
And listen to a little bit of good radio. I thought that if it was the opposite. If the weather was terrible, that's when you would cozy up. But when it's a lovely day, forget reading. Let's go out and
I think what we're saying is always a good time for audio
read.
Books.
Just please read.
Just read. Exactly. I came across, the New York Times this morning. And I like this publishing company, which is doing a very good job. They've got obviously some presses in the UK, where once upon a time you'd go to the newsstand and they had those newspapers that were all sort of stapled together and they were just printed out on A3 sheets of paper. But now they've actually, you can get the South China Morning Post, you can get the New York Times, pretty much as they almost are. They're a little bit slimmed down, so you might need big spectacles if your site isn't that great. But you're pretty much getting the real deal.
But nonetheless, you get a newspaper.
You're getting
as you
a proper
would
newspaper.
Expect a newspaper.
Exactly.
To be.
Anyway, today a cover of the New York Times Saturday edition. West sees Libya as opportunity for businesses, which is leading on sort of the right hand column. It says Europeans and Asians ahead of the Americans on the path to help rebuild the country, which is quite interesting because I think we saw a number of false starts. Gaddafi inviting a number of people for grand projects that never quite got off the ground. But I would imagine that when all normal flights resume, there's going to be a lot of people beating a path to the hotels, etc.
I think it'd be absolutely astonishing. I'm looking at the front cover of the FT Weekend, which is basically the exact, pretty much a carbon copy of the Il Sole, the 24-hour one, the Italian finance paper. And everything is just absolutely being dominated by the EU deal, where, like you say, they're looking to Japan and China for extra finance now because they're desperate to get the private sector into this enormous euro bailout zone, because otherwise there's going to be no money.
Well, exactly, and I think it's very much a case of safety in numbers. The more people we can bring into it, the less likely it's guaranteed not to fail. And the New York Times, just going back to them, the Business Day section leads on, a spotlight now shines on Italy. It says, it finally dawned on me, and this is a comment piece by James B. Stewart, it finally dawned on me this week that the value of my retirement account might depend on Silvio Berlusconi.
It's terrifying,
yeah,
isn't it?
That's not sort of a great prospect or thought to wake up to over the weekend.
It's not. I mean, the Italians are waking up to pages and pages and pages of this. They're having to wake up to the fact that their cost of borrowing has reached a record high and they're selling bonds at 6%, and apparently above 6%, it's not sustainable. It's a real, real problem. The FT is mirroring this by saying its headline is Italy spoils the mood. So it is this horrendous thing that despite this intervention by the central bank, and despite all these issues and these efforts to help, if Berlusconi can't get his house in order, and he has until pretty much the end of the year, because he'll probably try and go for re-election.
Yeah,
you are right. Everybody's pensions are unknown.
Yeah, pretty much. Also, on the business page of the New York Times this morning, very interesting story about Hulu and talking that talking about the fact that the future for perhaps many of these streaming brands around the world might lie in, or at least their fortunes might lie in anime. And it says that one of the most popular options on Hulu, ranking alongside mainstream TV hits like Modern Family and Glee, is an animated series about an adolescent ninja and his pink-haired love interest battling a mysterious organization. It's called Naruto Shippuden. It's a Japanese anime set in an area reminiscent of the Okayama Prefecture. And, obviously what's interesting about this is great for the fortunes of all of these Japanese publishing companies, which I always find amazing because it's one of the great untold stories that whether it's Kodansha, a number of major, players, in the manga scene in Japan, who of course do, everything from newspapers, through to regular magazines. But, they've got these enormous, back catalogs, and they've certainly started to exploit, near markets, so the success of manga in markets like Thailand and Taiwan
and Europe
elsewhere
as well.
And now sort of moving into Europe, and then just the strength of these catalogs, which they haven't even really dipped into yet. So good news if you're one of those Japanese publishing companies.
Well, it makes me think of on a much more sort of immediate and less high quality scale. Mm. We were doing something on Midori House sometimes next week on the South Koreans and the Taiwanese, and the Taiwanese especially, who are doing this absolutely astonishing anime, very, very low quality, low budget cartoons that reflect and create a parody of those news day of the big news stories of the day. So I think the Tiger Woods being pursued by his wife and the Nine-Iron went viral around the world. And what it's doing is it's making the Taiwanese suddenly become big players with very cheap materials on the global scene of news and parody.
Yeah.
And apparently it's infuriating the Chinese.
Oh, I'm sure the Chinese, they're loving it in Beijing. What are you saying?
They're desperate to put through great news stories, and instead there's about 10 people in Taiwan who are just sorting everybody else out.
Well, we heard it in the bulletin at the top of the hour, and there's not too much of it in the papers this morning because it's really happening as we speak. But we were talking about it yesterday on Midori House, just the rather fractious investors conference, annual general meeting for Qantas yesterday, and since then the whole thing is grounded.
It's gone It's taken a direction which, frankly, I wasn't quite prepared for, because I think it had been a half-hour strike had been held by baggage handlers this time yesterday.
As soon as we went off air, it all went very, very wrong.
Did we say something we shouldn't have done?
But I was going to say, okay, you don't want to be flying in Australia today. One in five Air France flights are not going. There's potentially this 10 inches of snow heading towards the US East Coast, and then all those people kicking off in the north of England, with their flight not taking
off. Stay at home. Listen to Monocle 24.
Yeah, I think, much better to be in a cozy studio. Anyway, we're going to continue with our review of all things media related, and we'll be doing books, at least hearing about from our booksellers around the world in a moment. But first, a very short break. And you're back with a review here on Monocle 24. Now, in this weekly program, we do checks on the latest in books, films, and events all around the world. And today, it's time to check in for what our favorite bookshops are selling around the world, and we start in India.
I'm Harpreet Singh, and I'm managing the Full Circle bookstores in Delhi. Basically, we deal in books of all kinds. And at present, Full Circle bookstores are only in New Delhi. So one of the best sellers this week has been Noon by Atish Taseer, who is the son of Mr. Taseer, who was the chief minister of Punjab in Pakistan. He was assassinated, unfortunately, for standing up against the Orthodox Muslims. There are other Pakistani authors also are doing very well. This is a very positive change because a lot of Pakistani authors are doing well, not only in India, I think all over the international scene. And it's opening up our eyes to reality, which we never thought existed in Pakistan. So we're selling very good books from a young girl called Jabeen Akhtar. She wrote about her stint in America. And it's partly very funny and partly very heartrending. And Muhammad Hanif, the author of Case of the Exploding Mangoes, has come out with a second book, Our Lady of Alice Bhatti. The book is doing extremely well, but I think The Case of Exploding Mangoes was a laugh riot, and it's still selling very well.
Hi, my name is Gökner Marsh, and I'm a manager of Pandora Bookstore, and is located in central of Istanbul, Beyoğlu, Taksim. We have been selling in great numbers lately. Sermagos Kabil, it's a novel and about holy books from Adam and Eve to us. An embodied century, it's about 20th century, and he undertakes to re-examine the century. It's about activating the true. It's a philosophical book. Also, Umberto Eco's Prague Cemetery, it's about 19th century. It's a historical novel. And Eagleton's How to Read a Poem. Another one is Zizek's Parallax View, about parallax gap of dialectical materialism. From the last week, well, I recommend Century from Badiou. Also, Ram Diary, Hunter Thompson's book, and Daniel Taniro's Green Capitalism is Impossible. And another one is Michel Lewy's Reading Marx. Well, I'm excited about coming week's books from one of them, Border Watch. It's about urban transformation, cultures of immigration, detention and control. It will be published by Pluto Press. And The Lesions of Economics, it's a critic of economic from a social and historical perspectives. Another one is Claude Lévi-Strauss. It will be published in Bloomsbury. It's about his artistic side, Poets in the Laboratory.
My name is Cyrus and I work at Berkelow Books in Paddington in Australia, Sydney, Australia. I don't think there's really so much a trend heading towards fiction, more non-fiction, what I've noticed recently, but people are still reading like the big names in fiction, so like the Jonathan Franzens or like the Jeffrey Eugenides, who's just released a new book. They're still flocking to the big names, but I think it's majority non-fiction, actually. History is a big seller here in Paddington. Australian history stuff is always a big seller here, but I think the biggest would probably have to be biographies. Mainly political ones, and even comedians' biographies have been selling quite well, like the Tina Fey one, the new Ellen DeGeneres one as well, and also an Australian comedian named Arne Doe released a book called The Happiest Refugee, which has been one of our biggest sellers this year. The new Steve Jobs, it's been flying off the shelves. We've sold out, and we've only really had it for the past 6 days, so that's going to be the massive one in the next couple of weeks. So
that was Cyrus, the worker at Berkelow Books in Sydney, Australia, ending that roundup of global book trends. Well, global book trends, as exemplified by three shops
by three cities,
around the world,
which isn't a bad sample. I have to say, I often zip past Berkelow Books, partly because it's on. It's on Oxford Street in Sydney, and it's always sort of very difficult to stop. But I'm always heading to Leslie Mackay,
right,
which is great, which is a wonderful, wonderful little bookshop in Willowar. So we're going to have to get the people on from Leslie Mackay.
I want to go back to the one in Istanbul where everybody's buying Umberto Eco and lovely racy detective stories, and
yeah,
she wants us to buy a dialectical, a materialistic tract.
Yeah, I was thinking, I'm going to be sort of parked out on my terrace.
And a copy of The Rum Diaries by Hunter S. Thompson. Yeah. I don't know which one to choose.
Yeah, on my terrace, parked out of looking over the Bosphorus. I'm not quite sure about that. In between, though, we're going to have we've got a few hours off this afternoon, so I'm thinking I would like to dash across the park and go to Daunt and fill up a bag or two.
I was there yesterday evening listening to a talk.
It was
Jeremy Paxman doing Paxman. Something about the Empire, and it was the most. It was a very, very good slideshow, but it was absolutely packed because I think people were less interested in the subject matter and more interested in this presenter who's incredibly famous in the United Kingdom for his incredibly aggressive way and probing way of interviewing his subjects. And so I think everybody wanted to see if he was just as aggressive as he is in real life. And of course, he's not. He's just a very good writer.
It was someone interviewing him, or was he just presenting on his own?
No, he stood up and did a half-hour talk about how the empire has affected the British identity.
And he's talking about empire, not in the broader sense. He's talking empire as it applies to these islands.
As it applies to the British Empire and how it, and our involvements in the slave trade and our involvements in India. Mm. But what he did is he did a slideshow, and it was astonishing. It was just like watching a family slideshow, but of incredibly odd pictures dating back to, you know, the early 19th century and beyond that, but hosted by Jeremy Paxman. It was quite a bizarre evening, to be honest.
Well, they do wonderful events over at Daunt. They're always, you know, quite cosy, and people are sort of packed in with their glass of white wine. And
it has a very nostalgic and romantic air to it. I think Daunt Books has a very unique feeling to it, because we were up on the gallery.
Right.
And you felt like you were in a very old, beautiful library. And the temptation actually was to just gently remove books and flick through them while you were sitting down.
Oh, I thought you were going to say stuff them in your handbag.
Oh, no, you can't do that. I'll try and read them before you leave. I'd never stuff a book in my handbag.
It's like, what are you advocating?
Oh, never, never. No. But it was one of those things that you attempted to read, despite the fact that you had paid to listen to someone else talking, so it was slightly disrespectful.
Right.
But I hope he doesn't hear that.
But I have a feeling, just because of it, really, it's the coziness of that space and the creakiness of it. Mm. That every time they have an event, it just gets busier and busier, because I think people are looking for that type of social glue.
They sell out months in advance to these things, and you get an absolutely wide-ranging group of people coming in to talk, and they pull in all the big names as well, and so you're incredibly lucky if you actually get a seat at Daunt. Mm. It's a good place to go. You only wish that other shops would be able to do such a thing, or that there could be a... I'd be interested to see how widespread a tradition like that could form in other bookshops.
Mm. James Daunt is here on Monday. We'll be dragging him into the studio, hopefully, as well. Not dragging, we'll be escorting him in gently. But he's doing a talk in the big studio space just beyond here.
He'll be he's taken over the big chain in the United Kingdom, hasn't he?
Yes, Waterstones.
If we're allowed to mention that. And he's now removing the sort of pile 'em high, sell 'em cheap attitude, aren't they?
Yeah.
Of the three for two, which I am victim to. I go for that hook, line and sinker, unfortunately.
Really?
Oh, I'm terrible.
Oh,
I'm
no.
terrible. I'm a smash and grabber.
Oh, really? Yeah,
cheap reader.
I'm never that taken, sort of, because I always sort of feel that it's some, you know, incentive scheme which has been, you know, drawn up, you know, by, you know, a bunch of accountants just to flog these things.
Oh, absolutely. It's supermarket bookshopping.
Yeah, I can't do it. Anyway, I'm fascinated to see what James does, because I think this is a massive turning point for, let's say, mass retail when it comes to bookselling, because if this works and he's able to take, you know, a chain which has, you know, scores and scores of outlets up and down the country, and, you know, stave off it, you know, going the direction of a Borders, you know, well, both in this couple, Borders all over the world, it'll be quite a miracle.
If you can bring a touch of what made him great at Daunt to Waterstones, and I think it will be an astonishing coup.
Yeah.
Because I think Waterstones has turned into, like I say, a sort of smash and grab supermarket.
Yeah, and I think part of the problem there too, it's you know, it's not just what is the list. You know, what James has done when you go into his stores is that you have people working there who are passionate about books.
Oh, yes. I bought a present for a child a few months ago involving a children's book that I had read as a little girl, and I took it and I wanted to give it as a present to this little boy who I was going to visit. And I took it to the desk, and the man behind the counter burst into tears.
Mm.
And I said, why? And he said, I read it and it was my childhood. And I'd never had that kind of reaction from a bookseller.
No.
I was, are you all right? And he went, yes, it was just a beautiful book. And okay. I love that sort of passion and love for it.
Yeah. Should we tell everyone what time it is?
It's 24 minutes past the hour here at Monocle 24. If I look up, nearly 25 past.
It is. So we're going to go away for a short break, and we're heading to Finland right after this.
J. Crew is thrilled to be shipping across the pond to our customers in the UK. Shop our famous collection of colourful cashmere and wardrobe staples for men, women and children. At J.Crew you can always expect impeccable quality, design integrity and flawless customer service every time you shop. Visit jcrew.com for the full story.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes, and quips of the week, tune in to The Curator every Sunday here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest of the week in world affairs, business, culture, and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, and Emma Nelson. It's just coming up to 26 minutes past the hour. If you're waking up on the USS East Coast, that would be after the hour of 7 a.m. Last week, we had the wonderful Bernie Cho on the program. He joined us on the line from Seoul. He's one of our favorite music people in Asia. And today, we thought we should maybe go to the far side of the Baltic.
We're going north. So hopefully we should be joined on the phone from Helsinki in Finland by the Finnish musician and radio presenter Markus Nordenstrand. Markus, are you there?
I am here.
A very good morning, good afternoon, or good evening to you. How is Helsinki this lunchtime?
It's beautiful. Sunny, warm, not very normal for this time of the year, but planet Earth has been acting weird lately, so...
I was going to say, hi Markus, it's Tyler. I was going to say, it's fantastic here that it's still sunny, because I always feel by the time November's upon us, you know, even at this time of day, because it's just about 2:30 there, correct? That the sun is already starting to dip and it's almost evening time.
Well, no, not right now for some reason. We have daylight savings, I think, tomorrow night. We're supposed to put our clocks back 1 hour, so... Usually, I'm not fond of the time right after that, because then days tend to feel shorter than they actually are.
So. Mm. We want to talk about all things media-related, but tell us what has you excited right now in terms of what you're finding in shops or maybe also what you're playing on your radio station in Helsinki?
Music-wise? I'm not particularly, looking into what's really new and happening. I'm kind of, I don't know, I guess it comes with age. I'm sort of more interested in finding roots to the music that people are thinking as the hippest thing in the world. Usually it has roots, 20, 30 years back. And that's sort of the music that I listen to the most.
So give us an example of what's been getting you.
Well, one of the artists Finnish artists that I really, really love from years back was this band called Wigwam, who were actually very close to signing with Richard Branson's Virgin back in the 70s. And I don't know why, maybe it's this time of the year that I really dig their sound. They had sort of a prog rock sound, something that was very popular like about a year ago in the world, but as mentioned, the roots are in the mid-70s, early mid-70s.
Now, you've composed for the likes of Kings of Leon, haven't you? What kind of, what degree of Finnish music, to how much does Finnish music influence your composition when you come to writing for big bands, big global bands like Kings of Leon?
Well, as far as I know, I haven't written for Kings of Leon.
Oh, my apologies. I'm so sorry. I've
written for quite a few artists, and I've collaborated with some well-known acts, I suppose. But I think it's essentially doing music. The way I approach it is just like when I start playing, it's just like being excited about a particular chord or a particular phrase, and then it kind of just builds. The songs sort of write themselves. That's, I guess, the best way of capturing it. I don't think there's any real logic or a formula. Whenever I think there is, usually I end up not being able to finish that particular song or just writing a crappy song. I think the best songs are sort of...
No such thing.
Why don't we have a listen, Markus, to what you mentioned first? Because I know we've got two songs lined up from you today, but this is Wigwam with Wishful Thinker. Away. And that was Wigwam, and the song is Wishful Thinker. We're joined by Marcus Nordenstrang in Helsinki, who's on the line. Just to tell us a little bit about, more about Wigwam, where do they fit into the general music scene in Finland?
Well, they were sort of, at their most, their biggest moment was probably in the early to mid 70s. They started, I think, in the late 60s in Helsinki, and they had a singer, an Englishman named Jim Pembroke, who had moved to Finland for some weird reason. I don't know what brought him here, but he started the band, and then somehow they got signed to a Finnish label called Love Records, who were pretty much the only really happening label in Finland at that time. I think we had one bigger label here back then, but other than that, it was kind of dead as far as the music industry went, and they somehow, the word spread out, and suddenly, like, Richard Branson was aware of them and wanted to sign them, and there was another band on that label on Love Records called Tasavallan Presidentti, and they were also very close to signing with Virgin. Then it never happened, and
Marcus, I wanted to ask.
Those are great records.
I wanted to ask you. We're in the middle of the weekend. Whether you're in London or whether you're in Helsinki, what does your weekend media diet look like? Because of course, in the UK, it's defined by, of course, the Sunday papers and people consuming many of them, very high doses of candy floss television or settling down with downloading something on TV. But I'm always amazed in Helsinki because you still have this wonderful thing called a DVD shop all over the center of the city. When you wander around, you see these cute little stores. They serve, they've got lots of, candy, and you can buy lots of crisps. And that's really evaporated in the UK.
That has a retro sound to it when you actually talk about it, even though 2-3 years ago they were absolutely everywhere.
Yeah. So what is Marcus Nordenstrang's weekend media diet look like?
From what I hear, those DVD stores, they're DVD rental stores, basically, and I hear that they're actually making more money from selling those candies than they do from renting DVDs.
It's always been the case, though.
Yeah, I guess so, but I mean, the whole, it's an interesting time. I mean, music industry has certainly went through quite a change in the last 10 years.
And, what kind of change has that been?
Well, people just not buying records anymore. I mean, people downloading, and certainly, I think you guys probably in England, Spotify has taken off, which is a pretty cool little device that you can use online, and just, if you're a music fan, you can find so much great music that way. But it also means that people spend more time by their computers listening to music than they do at home listening to their stereos. So it's a huge change,
and a lot of labels
are folding, a lot of record stores are folding, which is, which I'm sad for, but then again, the infrastructure is just changing, and there's kind of nothing we can do about it.
So what kind of music are they now going towards? Because when we heard Wigwam, I was actually quite surprised by how non-Finnish it sounded. And then you told me that there was a British singer on there, and that kind of explained everything. And you're saying now that Finnish labels are folding. So what is the Finnish taste moving towards?
I think it's, indie rock does well here, as it does anywhere in the world, I guess. But we also have, Finns are special in the sense that Finns buy a lot of Finnish music, which is not very typical if you look at, like, record sales worldwide. In a lot of countries in England, in Europe, for instance, they mainly buy English and American records, whereas over here it's mainly Finnish artists that Finns buy. So that's kind of a cool thing. There's a big metal scene. Same as Norway. Norway and Finland are like the big, black metal countries, I guess. And there's a huge scene for that. And then there's like a schlager thing, which is like sort of old Finnish dance music, I guess. There's actually a song contest tonight on telly, and it's one of the most viewed programs of the year, which is all about that particular style. And it's like as far from indie rock as you can get, basically.
So that's what the Finns are getting up to on a weekend, then?
Yeah, well, yeah, this weekend especially. I think a lot of foreigners are always surprised by the fact that shops close pretty early during the weekends, and many times on Sundays a lot of shops are remain closed, whereas I guess, you know, in a lot of other countries they do a lot of business during the weekends, but for some reason not in Finland.
I just want to say, you know, along with all of these wonderfully quaint DVD stores that you see, you know, the other thing that you notice in the center of Helsinki are just the sheer number, and maybe it goes to, of course, the Schlager contest and also all of the general heavy metal scene, is the sheer number of instrument shops. It's remarkable and it must have something to do with, of course, the long evenings, maybe over the winter time. Maybe that's where all of sort of, you know, the heavy metal garage bands come from, because I guess people, they have to do something if the shops aren't open and the nights are long.
Yeah, I guess so. I think we have, considering that there are only, you know, 5.5 million Finns, there are a lot of great musicians that have come out of Finland. Not necessarily that many great singers, but there are a lot of great players. I mean, whether you're talking about, like, well, as I mentioned, Wigwam, you know, those guys were great players, and some of those guys are still alive, and I certainly respect them. But I mean, it kind of goes way back to the 60s, 70s, and then all the way to this day. Like, I think there's a heavy metal guitar player who was just voted in either Guitar Player or Guitar World magazine just very recently as the greatest metal player. So, I don't know. I mean, there's like a whole scene, and there are some great country players in Finland. There are some great folk musicians, you know.
Marcus, I just wanted to say that we're running out of time, but we're going to leave you to get on with your weekend. And we're going to play something. This is from your little operation. This is Late Birds, Among the Survivors. And we wish you a very good weekend.
Well, thanks. Likewise.
Okay, kiitos.
Doesn't your mouth get ever tired of talking? Doesn't your mind ever stop you?
And that was the Late Birds, Among the Survivors. That was a little something from Marcus Nordenstreng, who we were chatting to a little bit earlier in the program. We're going to go away for a short break, and then it's time for our magazine review. We're back after this on The Review.
J. Crew is thrilled to be shipping across the pond to our customers in the UK. Shop our famous collection of colourful cashmere and wardrobe staples for men, women and children. At J.Crew, you can always expect impeccable quality, design integrity and flawless customer service every time you shop. Visit jcrew.com for the full story.
Every month, the Monocle Shop unveils a new collection of collaborations available on monocle.com and in our shops in London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Tokyo, and Osaka. This month sees a range of new bags added to our collection from Porter of Japan, a new blazer from London-based designer Oliver Spencer, as well as our regular lineup of stationery, CDs, posters, and books. Pop into our shops or visit us online at shop.monocle.com.
And a very warm welcome back to The Review here on Monocle 24 now. What would be nicer during a Saturday afternoon or evening or morning, depending where you are around the world, and to have a cup of coffee, which we have got.
Print, more print.
We haven't got enough around here. I can't move for the stuff. We've been joined by Michael Salu, who's a designer and art director at Granta. A very warm welcome to you,
Michael. Good afternoon.
Oh, you have the best voice I have had. I'm no disrespect to Tyler, but
no,
I'm just going to be quiet now, and I'm just going to let you speak.
It's probably better for late night radio.
Well, somewhere in the world, someone is listening, and it's late. Late night radio.
Yeah, it's almost 1 a.m. in Auckland. So
good evening.
You
can
talk to the Kiwis. Exactly.
Tell us what Granta is.
Well, Granta is a sort of quarterly literary magazine. We publish a range of fiction, non-fiction, poetry, and also art and photography, all related to a different theme each time for each issue. It's been in print consistently since 1979, but was actually founded in 1889.
It started in Cambridge, didn't it?
It did indeed, as a sort of journal, which was sort of quite a little bit controversial and sort of tongue-in-cheek, and it sort of had went through various guises over the years, and Bill Buford, the initial editor from, he restarted it in 1979, and it's been consistent ever since then, and we're now on issue 118, or 17, sorry.
And how would you describe its latest guise after such an evolution?
Oh, goodness me. we have a new editor, John Freeman, who's been sort of with the magazine now for just over 2 years. And subsequently, we have a whole sort of brand new team in there. But we still retain the same sense of urgency and sort of, you know, creative approach to each individual theme.
I mean, this the latest one that I have in my hand. I mean, I didn't actually think it was a magazine. And then I realised it's a magazine of new writing, so it's going to be a book.
It sort of, it confuses everyone.
hands up, guilty. I was confused. But the names that you pull in to contribute, I mean, this one is what? Horror. Paul Auster, Stephen King and Will Self. Who else could you possibly want?
Absolutely,
well, not necessarily extraordinary if you're pitching that high the whole time.
Yeah.
It must be a great pleasure thinking of who you want to write for you.
Oh, precisely.
And they're always special commissions in this case.
Precisely. Yeah. So is it the commissions? We have a sort of varied approach to it. So obviously we work with lots of literary agents who, and constantly reminding agents of what themes we're working on, seeing what work they might have available. Occasionally they're extracts from novels that are actually coming up, you know, in due course. And then there are special commission pieces for each individual issue, which tend to be sort of non-fiction pieces. And in addition to that, we have obviously a lot of poetry that's submitted to us, as well as artwork and photography.
So when it came to choosing your horror people, did you just ring up Stephen King and said, Stephen, we have a magazine coming up, help
pretty
us out?
Much, yes.
It was as simple as that. And they just jumped to you.
Yeah. So it's. I think we sort of get really good responses to each theme that we actually engage with. And I think I'm sort of quite sort of happy the way, you know, people generally respond to each magazine that we put out there.
I wanted to ask you from, not getting straight into business, but I think it's really good value. It's £12.99, £16.99 in the US, and in many ways you're almost sort of ahead of the curve. That you know, here is a title which, you know, at a time when everyone is so focused on what the, you know, the physical essence of you know, a publication should be, and you've got this, you know, this great frequency to it. Do you find that actually more people are embracing this because it's so opposite to, yeah, you know, everything, you know, that we talk about, you know, the good and the bad of digital, but I think it's the antidote to what's the bad.
Very much so, and I think we're not ignoring the digital, and we're actually working on that at the moment as we speak. But there's something to be said with the value of a rather well-produced printed item, which I think still resonates somewhat in a way that we have this, you know, sort of constant stream of information, and it's very difficult to detach yourself from that.
And, well, I think also too, because people I think often forget when you sit in media companies how the consumer also defines themselves by what they collect.
Precisely.
And you know, you walk into anyone's environment, and it's, you know, whether you're in someone's office or you walk into their living room, and you know I get, you know, at the core of the individual is, you know, what do you surround yourselves with, and so often you just see people, you know, with their wonderful Granta collections.
Precisely, and they do the rounds, and you'll see them old issues, and they continuously move through secondhand bookstores. And they recollected, and I've met quite a few people of, you know, similar age to myself who have almost an entire back catalogue of Granta magazine. And for what it's worth, it's not a magazine that will date, because we're focusing on, although they're topical, they tend to deal with sort of quite broad issues that, you know, that are sort of.
Because yes, you could go back and read some of your wonderful reportage, and it is quite timeless, because you know, it delivers you to a moment, and you know, then it becomes an historical piece.
Yeah.
Seems to offer is something that we were talking about earlier on, which is the gradual transition from, we were talking about Daunt Books on Marylebone High Street in London, which,
and I think
has
a good outlet for you.
Yeah, a very good outlet, which has an incredibly physical aspect to it. By the way, you smell the books, you feel, and you can hear people walking around with the wood, and it's a very total experience when you go in there. And then we were comparing it to the smash and grab of Waterstones, which has obviously opened books out to millions of people and millions of new readers, but possibly misses that sort of lovely physical essence. But you seem to combine both, because you have the physicality of this beautifully produced magazine, yet you do manage to sort of offer a taste of every kind of literature that's being put out on the market.
Yes, and I think obviously we operate, we just want to publish the best new writing. So you'll notice there are a lot of established names that we have in there, but there are also a lot of new writers as well. And our editors do make a sort of lot of... put a lot of effort into finding new writers, and it works as a platform to launch new work, and it always has done. I mean, the likes of Salman Rushdie and Martin Amis published their very first works in Granta, and it's that sort of legacy that we try and continue in.
What is your benchmark? I mean, obviously, you know, do you have to be Salman Rushdie in order to get onto the pages?
No, not
what
necessarily.
Do you look for?
I think we just look for originality. We look for people who, you know, who take the written word and actually do something new and unique with it. I mean, two to three issues ago, we published our Aliens issue, and we have a brand new writer in here who just finished a creative writing degree. His name's Chris Dennis, and produced the most awesome short story. And it was actually existed in our slush pile. So we have this sort of submission process, and you know, our publisher and our interns sift through a lot of the submissions, and this just stood out and went straight into the magazine. So...
We should we can talk about Grant all day as well, but we've probably given enough airtime. I want to maybe just jump into some other things. You brought in a very tasty looking title for our magazine, and it could hardly be called a magazine, but it is a magazine.
It's quite incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, tell us about it.
What is it?
This is a publication called Grey, and I sort of met the publisher a few months ago.
Is it British?
No, actually. It's sort of founded in between Italy and New York. And it's sort of a fashion magazine / fiction and poetry magazine, which is sort of an unusual combination, but somehow seems to work. It's an incredibly large format. It's beautifully printed, hardback book, released twice a year. Production values are rather extraordinary. And even the what you might call the fashion shoots are not particularly linear in that sense. And they're sort of more visual stories, which they obviously include the fashion, include the models and the clothing into. And then we have a lot of contributions from various writers and so on, and poets and illustrators.
And is there, I will always come back to the business model, it's the publisher in me. Is there advertising?
There is advertising, but it's fairly spare. As in, you see some at the beginning, you'll see some at the end. So it doesn't interrupt the overall narratives.
It looks... I've seen it at a couple of places, and it's just... And again, I think it's completely just the reaction, I think, to where the market is now.
Oh, it's absolutely high-end. If you could possibly open up a couple of pages and show them to us, Michael, because if you could describe what you can see in front of you, just to give us a taste of what it's like. I mean, I can already hear from the other side of the room that the paper is exquisite.
Yeah, exactly.
I just want to reach out and touch
it. It's
terrible.
Produced.
So, it's another complete experience.
So again, as I was saying, you have fashion spreads which are done more as sort of narrative visual stories. Very different styles of photography. Incredibly rich, beautifully produced, and then as you can see here, you move into the poetry and fiction section, in which you have the illustration complementing the text, but the two, they don't integrate. They're not, you know, your story isn't interrupted. You're still able to read rather smoothly through this, and it's rather tongue in cheek as well. I mean, there's an article here, a story by Julian Goff, which is called Tarkovsky's Barney, and it addresses the fact that Tarkovsky, you know, actually had a diary. This is obviously entirely untrue, but he had a diary in which Barney, the television dinosaur, actually had a...
Right.
actually
Hang
had
on,
a
how did he manage
less,
to get into the pages of Grey?
Actually had a slightly less sanitary lifestyle, and this is what the actual story addresses. So it's very amusing as well as being beautifully designed as well.
I was over on the high street. I went to Greens, which is one of our good locals here in Marylebone. And if anyone gets a chance over the weekend, and just you want a bit of background on Occupy Wall Street, Bloomberg's Business Week is in a very good story this week.
Right.
And it's Who's Behind the Mask. It's written by Drake Bennett, and it says, "Meet David Graeber, the anthropologist, activist, anarchist, and anti-leader who helped transform a hapless rally into a global protest movement." And there's also then Roger Lowenstein writes this piece off the back. It says, it's not a hippie thing. Don't be fooled by the drum circles. Today's protests have more in common with the anti-Hoover 1930s than the anti-war 60s and 70s. But a very great piece of analysis and something that they do very well. And my other recommendation is pick up World of Interiors, the November issue, because there is, I think when, you know, let's say more commercial magazine publishing hits its stride, there is the most exquisite story on one of the faculty buildings that Gio Ponti did at Padua University, and it is just sumptuous. It is photographically just wonderfully executed, I think for sort of a traditional glossy, but it's just the work of Ponti. And And it comes back to, you know, when Italy hits its stride and when Italy does things well, and you see something like this also within an academic institution, it's really this is delicious publishing.
Mm. Well, just looking at the pictures of that from the academy, it's a combination of the modern and the beautiful old Italian design. And I've got in front of me a copy of Baku, which is Condé Nast's decision to publish an international version of their Eurasian magazine. And like the magazine you have in front of you, it's absolutely style based and just the methods of production are just exquisite. But they have a whole article, Tyler, that you were mentioning of that beautiful old Italian university. That combination of modern and old masters is the thing at the moment.
Exactly. And we should add something of a mouthpiece also for the government of Azerbaijan too. That's a whole other funding model.
The president's daughter's behind it.
Absolutely. Michael Sullivan, thank you very much for being here for granted today. And that is all for this edition of The Review. The Monocle Weekly is back tomorrow at 11 a.m. London time, but that's all for now. Goodbye.
The Rolex Datejust is a universally recognized symbol and keeper of the most precious and rare commodity in the world, time. Imagine a synchronizing watch mechanism that harnesses the energy stored in the watch's movement and signals a change every second time the hands of the watch reach 12 o'clock, meaning that it is able to differentiate between noon and midnight. In true Rolex tradition, an in-house foundry in Geneva works to the company's exacting standards, crafting the oyster case of the Rolex Datejust from a single metal ingot. Those who understand and appreciate what it means to have a passion for excellence know that with a Rolex on your wrist, time is never out of fashion. The watch they wear, the Rolex Datejust. Rolex. Live for greatness.